Morning, Catherine.
Morning. It pleased the court, my name is Christy Bullitt, and I represent the Utility Water Act Group, or UAG, the applicant for intervention as defendant in this case. This case concerns two decisions by the district court, both of which are properly before this court. The first involves the district court's erroneous decision that the Clean Water Act actually imposes one or more of the non-discretionary duties that plaintiffs allege EPA failed to fulfill, thus giving the court subject matter jurisdiction under Section 505 of the Clean Water Act to compel EPA to conduct a rulemaking to revise the regulations that govern UAG member companies' power plants.
Now, who are you representing?
I represent the intervener applicant as defendant, yes, Your Honor.
Putative intervener.
Yes, the putative intervener, Your Honor.
Can you bring anything before us other than the issue of whether you were improperly denied intervention?
Well, this court always has jurisdiction to determine whether or not the lower court had subject matter jurisdiction.
And if we find that it had jurisdiction to have allowed you to intervene, I mean, if they find it improperly denied you intervention, shouldn't we send it back to relitigate the merits with you in the case, or?
The court could send it back, but it need not, since it's more than capable of determining on this very straightforward legal question of whether the statute imposes a non-discretionary duty or not. This court is more than competent to decide that. That's a straightforward question.
This
court has said it should be a straightforward question. I'm sorry.
Did the district court take up the jurisdictional issue?
Yes, it did.
It did.
It was briefed and argued. The district court did not provide for briefing on subject matter jurisdiction. It nevertheless decided that issue. It issued a decision determining that.
It should have decided subject matter jurisdiction.
It should have decided.
Whether right or wrong and whether argued or unargued.
Correct. It appears to have decided that issue as a predicate for accepting jurisdiction. It's important to understand.
The only point I was making, so we're actually, part of our decision is to review the decision that the district court handed down regarding jurisdiction. We have that decision in front of us.
Correct. Although that decision was made, as Judge Santel said, without the benefit of actual full briefing and argument on the jurisdictional question. And that question, that fundamental question.
I understand this is a bit of almost a chicken and egg or a circular question, but as to whether you can bring before us anything other than the denial of your intervention at this point.
Your Honor. And
you say rightly that we have jurisdiction to determine the subject matter jurisdiction, but we don't if nobody brings us the case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
do you have standing at this point to bring us anything other than the question of your intervention?
The point you make is an excellent one, and it really underscores our interest in intervention in the first. The fact that you are thinking about that question underscores the fact that we have an interest in, and a compelling one, in this jurisdictional question that warranted our intervention in the first instance.
Right now you have an appellate interest at this point. I'm not at all sure that you had a litigable interest at the time the district court said you didn't.
Well, what the district court said was that it had jurisdiction
over
the controversy, which in turn rested on its finding that the agency had a non-discretionary duty essentially to complete a review of all 58 effluent limitations guidelines, including ours, make a formal determination, and within the same deadline for review, which is all that the statute imposes, to, if a decision is to revise the guidelines is warranted, to actually issue those rules, which we have said in our pleadings is an impossible requirement that Congress didn't intend. It's not apparent on the face of the statute. It's not consistent with EPA's longstanding practice for prioritizing and making these determinations.
What is your interest, legally protectable interest, that you say should have given you standing in the district court?
We have several interests.
Start with one.
Okay. I'd be happy to, Your Honor. We have a legally protectable interest in that question of how frequently and through what process and by what deadline EPA has to revise our guidelines.
That sounds like a procedural standing argument. And we've said over and over that procedural standing arguments have to have substantive rights behind them in order to give standing. Now, what is the substantive right that makes that enough for Article III standing?
Well, the substantive right is the right to be free of more stringent effluent guidelines, which...
What more stringent guideline is going to be imposed upon you in this lawsuit?
Well, the plaintiff's theory of standing is that the application of the procedure that they seek to establish is substantially likely to result in more stringent guidelines more frequently than is consistent, would otherwise be the case if EPA were allowed to exercise the discretion.
That's back to the question whether they had standing, which is not, may or may not be yet before us.
But to the extent that their argument is that the statute requires revision, then we have an economic interest in that revision. And there is
there is at least a proposed rule that is more stringent, isn't it speculative to say that this would result in a rule change that would be detrimental to you? Don't look shocked at me.
Not at all. I'm thinking.
Okay. At least, isn't it speculative to say that there's going to be a rule that's going to affect your economic interest?
Well, no, because we certainly, while we have an enormous interest in the outcome of that rulemaking, we are not willing participants in that rulemaking. It is not entirely up to us whether or not we have to expend resources and encounter those economic burdens that go with the rulemaking. We are the repository of the information that the agency
needs. The burdens in the rulemaking, I don't think you can make that standing. Is there a case where we say that the cost of going through a rulemaking is enough to give you standing in Article III court?
Well,
I'm not
familiar with a case where the court has ever said that the industry that is directly regulated by a rulemaking doesn't have an economic interest.
I have no doubt that you would have if there were a rulemaking. You see, the problem we have here is there isn't a rulemaking. Once the rulemaking begins, won't you have the same rights in the rulemaking that you would have had if it had begun without litigation?
Maybe an example will help.
Maybe an answer would help.
And I'm trying to give you one. Most definitely want to answer your question. It's a fairly simple example. Over the course of the last 20 years, UAG has been compelled to answer ICRs, to provide data, to participate in site visits and accommodate all of that, all of which has an economic impact on those who have to supply that information. And we showed by affidavit that
none of that is caused by this litigation.
Actually, there's
none of that. You were doing that over.
We
you just said
that.
What 20 years?
But now, if the plaintiffs are correct, we will have to do that every year. So the economic impact is the difference between doing it every time EPA, in its discretion, decides that it's time to do a rulemaking, and the impact of doing it every single year. And that is a huge impact, and it's not just an impact that EPA bears. That impact falls on us because we are the essential repositories of that information. That's what makes our interest different than some generalized interest in rulemaking.
So the challenge is not simply to the consent decree, the schedule set forth in the consent decree? I see.
It's
more fundamental.
Although we have an interest in that.
Right.
We have an interest in that, and an interest that we supported.
Although the interest in the consent decree is wouldn't be a whole lot different than, I mean, the EPA had announced that they were going to go ahead with this review anyway, right?
EPA had.
The consent decree may impose a different guideline, a different schedule. I think it terminated a few months earlier, but there's not a significant difference between the consent decree schedule and what the EPA had announced it was going to do anyway.
There are two differences. One difference is that to enter that decree, the court had to accept jurisdiction and therefore accept, and that's apparent on the face of the decree, and it therefore had to accept that at least one of the non-discretionary duties that the plaintiffs claim the statute imposes actually exists. So that's one effect of the decree.
Why aren't you better? I mean, you're obviously the quarrel here is over what 301 and 304 mean and whether they're mandatory duties. Why aren't you better off waiting until the rulemaking actually begins and then to bring that challenge because
we can't.
Why can't
we? Don't have any ability. The agency can properly say we decided to do a rulemaking. That's a discretionary action.
Well, are you trying to say that you can enjoin or can get the court to enjoin them making a rulemaking?
Not at all.
And I don't see your point.
But what this court can do
is... Why isn't Judge Griffith right then?
Because this is not about whether EPA may do a rulemaking. This consent decree compels the agency to do a rulemaking. It says EPA didn't have a choice. It has to do a rulemaking. It can't change its mind. It can't decide that there's a higher priority. And it can't change the schedule without plaintiff's permission or this court's permission. So this is the difference between EPA having discretion to decide to do a rulemaking.
So would you say then that the rulemaking that proceeds would be flawed?
Well,
would you not have a chance to raise in that rulemaking any objection you have to the way the rulemaking is conducted?
I'm sure that as a creative lawyer, I would try to find some way to make
that
argument.
We know you're a creative lawyer.
But Your Honor,
we have no doubt about
do not think that EPA would concede that we can, in any way, shape, or form, raise the question about whether or not EPA had any non-discretionary duty to do this rulemaking or not, because at the end of the day, what is challengeable is the rule. That's what we can challenge.
Exactly. And there isn't a rule yet.
But there is a compulsion that Congress...
Or even a rulemaking, right?
Well, there is a rulemaking.
Well, we're not in it here, right? What you are in here is a lawsuit in district court.
Correct. Well,
if there's a rulemaking going on, then you can participate in that rulemaking.
I can participate in that rulemaking, but I can't in the circuit court, which has exclusive jurisdiction over arguments with final effluent limitations guidelines. I can't argue to that court that the rules are invalid because the district court compelled them. And in fact, one might very well make the argument that if there was any jurisdiction over this, if there's any quarrel that plaintiffs have, it's that EPA waited too long to decide to exercise its discretion to review this rule. And that is a question that implicates the circuit court's jurisdiction in its authority, its decision that whether effluent guidelines are defective or not. And so under track, that really is a jurisdiction. The jurisdiction there is vested in the circuit court. But back to...
Are you relying on paragraph 4 of this consent decree to say that a rulemaking has to occur?
Yes.
What are you relying on? Paragraph 4?
Could you refresh my recollection as to... Could you read paragraph 4 to me? I don't remember the numbered paragraph.
You don't have it with you?
I do have it.
Paragraph 4 says, no later than January 31st, 2014, which has, I take it, been extended a couple of times, the EPA administrator shall sign a decision taking final action following notice and comment rulemaking. Now, do you read final action to require the EPA to issue a rule as opposed to, say, having the notice and comment proposed rulemaking and deciding not to issue a rule?
Well, it will. Is your question, Your Honor, I want to make sure that I've got the question
right. I heard you say that they have to promulgate a rule according to the consent decree. And I'm asking you where that comes from, the consent decree. And the only place I can see is paragraph 4.
They must conduct a rulemaking. They they can decide at the end of the day not to revise the rules.
Yeah, that's not the question. Where are you getting that from? On what do you base that statement?
Well, they must propose action, and they must take final action. And all together collectively, that constitutes a rulemaking. Now, the outcome of that rulemaking may or may not be a change in a final rule, but it is procedurally, I'm referring to that as a rulemaking. If what you mean is, must the outcome of that process be a revised final rules, then no. But they must conduct a rulemaking, and they must do that on a specific schedule. And so they must make those decisions, and those are regulatory decisions. I see that my initial time is up. I'd be happy to answer more questions.
We don't pay a lot of attention to that when the court's still asking questions. We don't care if your time's used up.
All right.
Do my colleagues have further questions?
I just want to make sure that I understand. Your position is that you read the consent decree to require EPA to have a rulemaking proceeding. You do not read it to require EPA to actually promulgate a revised rule.
I do not read it, but plaintiffs claim procedural claim.
It's been 28 years,
correct.
Right?
That's correct. Yeah. That is correct. That's exactly right. And in fact, plaintiff's entire claim of standing rests on that.
What did you say?
Isn't your point that it's substantially likely that after 28 years that this will lead to new standards, new limitations?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And if that were not the case, then plaintiffs wouldn't have had standing to bring this case in the first place.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you so
we'll
much.
Hear from you in rebuttal if necessary, and I'll hear from the first of the appellees.
Yes, may it please the court, Robert Lundman representing the EPA. Ms. Peterson will be using the other half of our time. She represents plaintiffs, defenders of wildlife, and Sierra Club.
Since you entered into the consent decree, how do you read paragraph 4?
We think paragraph 4 is very clear that EPA, at the end of the process, needs to take a final action. That action could be a new rule, or it could be a decision not to issue any new rule at all. And obviously, what that rule may or may not say, the substance of it, is completely speculative at this point. It's not due until May 2014 under the current schedule. We're years away, and we do not know what that rule may or may not say. And so we can't know right now whether UWAG will be impacted by that rule, how it will be impacted. Mm-hmm. And because of all that speculation.
Since that would also be true of the plaintiffs, why do they have standing?
Well,
I have to confess that I don't see a total consistency in EPA's position on this.
Well, we haven't taken a position on plaintiff standing. We did think that...
Take one.
Do
they have standing?
Their complaint included sufficient allegations to support standing at the pleading
stage. How do they have standing if UWAG doesn't? UWAG is a regulated entity. They UWAG would seem to have a better initial grasp on standing than the public interest group.
I think that's right if we were at the final rule stage, but...
Let's go back to this lawsuit stage.
What plaintiffs
tell me, why is plaintiff's standing claim better than UWAG?
I think the theory here is they've alleged that the guidelines at issue are 28 years old.
Everybody agrees with that.
They haven't been revised.
They're 28 years old. That doesn't give them standing.
And the second part is
if they were 29 years old, that wouldn't give them standing.
Right. The statute imposes a duty on EPA to revise those. And EPA hasn't done that duty.
Does it? Where does it do that? In 301, it imposes a duty to review the guidelines, right? In 304, it imposes a duty to revise the guidelines if appropriate or as appropriate. That's not a mandatory duty. That's the language of discretion.
Right. If appropriate, clearly the substance of the...
304, is you can't find a mandatory duty in 304.
Thereafter revise. I mean, I think the theory is, we're comfortable with this at the complaint stage that they alleged enough here to get over the initial hurdle.
All right. Get back to that. What is it that makes their position stronger on standing than that of UWAG? Don't tell me about things that are true of both of them, but it being 28 years and there hadn't been any regulation. That's true of everybody. Tell me what about their claim gives them a better hold on standing than UWAG. Because you seem to be taking a position that UWAG doesn't have standing.
Right.
Tell me why they do if UAG doesn't.
The core difference is they're injured by the passage of time in a way that gives them standing. UAG is not injured.
UAG is a regulated entity under these very regulations.
Right. But
so they have, we would say, almost automatic interest in the regulation, the administration of the regulation. It takes affidavits to elevate plaintiffs to that statute. I don't see how you can take a consistent position and say that UAG doesn't have standing and plaintiffs does.
Well, I think the key difference is plaintiffs are injured by the passage of time and delay. And on their
no, they're not.
Well,
they're not injured by the passage of time and delay.
They're injured by the failure.
Time passes every day. We're injured by it. We all get older, but that doesn't give us standing to sue EPA over the fact that time has passed. What is it about this lawsuit that can be remedied for them that isn't equally remediable or for UAG?
Well, I think the difference here, and I think plaintiffs will be able to answer this better than I, but is
you got up first.
I did. They've alleged the plaintiffs have alleged that the failure of EPA to revise the effluent limitation guidelines has resulted in greater pollution in waters they use than there would be otherwise.
If they're correct in that and they prevail, will that then not impact UAG?
Well, if they're correct,
will that then not impact UAG if there's an order based on that theory?
The final rule very well will impact, will likely
the final rule is what you're talking about.
Right.
There's no impact on anybody unless there's a final rule. Now, how can it be said that that final rule is more impactful for standing purposes for plaintiff than it is for UAG?
Well, it's not the final rule that the final rule may or may not impact plaintiffs in a way that gives them standing. They're saying leaving the law as it is, leaving the guidelines at the 1982 level, that results in greater pollution than there should be if they're revised.
Not unless the rulemaking finds that that's the case.
Right. Well, at the end of the day, the rulemaking.
And if it does, doesn't it affect UAG if there is such a finding?
Well, I think the difference is that the absence of action given the obligation of EPA to revise these guidelines is what injures plaintiffs. That absence benefits UAG only when the rules go higher.
You concede that that absence in that theory benefits UAG?
Well, the
you concede that, right?
I concede that the delay
right
now.
Once you've conceded that, how can you possibly say that they don't have at least as good a claim on standing as plaintiffs does?
Because they have no legally protected interest in the delay. Delay is not what the Clean Water Act sets out here. It says these guidelines should be revised.
If the delay is affecting both litigants, affects one in one fashion, one in the opposite fashion, how can you say one has standing and the other one doesn't?
Because the effect is different, and one is protected by the statute and one's not. A legally protected interest in getting new guidelines, plaintiffs have that. A legally protected interest in EPA never acting, the statute says EPA is supposed to revise these. So that's the difference. The statute imposes a symmetrical obligation on the parties. And so that at the end of the day, UAG might be injured by the final rule in 2014, but it's not going to be.
Can I go back to my line? I don't think you're reciting the statute quite accurately. Plaintiffs may very well have a protected interest in 301 because that imposes a duty that the limitations be reviewed periodically, correct?
Right.
What is their interest in 304 and the revision of the guidelines? It seems to me that's the language of discretion. There's no duty upon the EPA to revise the guidelines, only if it's appropriate. So how can that be the basis? How can that be the basis for a protected interest for a citizen standing suit?
I think
only non-discretionary matters.
If they had alleged just the 304 B,
okay,
then that wouldn't be necessarily enough. Okay. They've alleged both. We think at the pleading stage, if you look at Steel Company, it says the courts should, before deciding whether they're standing or a jurisdiction at the pleading stage, should look at the complaint and not go through the whole legal analysis required at the end of the day to prove up the claim on the merits. EPA has decided here that their allegation was good enough to get over that initial hurdle, and in light of that, we wanted to enter a consent decree and go ahead with this rulemaking. We think that is a decision that makes sense, and there was enough here to get over the pleading jurisdictional hurdle. But beyond that, at the end of the day, would a claim, if litigated to conclusion under 304B, prove up a mandatory duty violation.
Not, yeah.
I'm not conceding that, and that would only occur if we went back, had this case on the merits, went all the way to judgment, and we'd have to see where we ended up. Attorney for UAG mentioned that they have a right to be more free of the more stringent effluent limitations guidelines. But that is only going to occur, as I said earlier, if we get to 2014 and a final action includes a final substantive rule. With respect to their injury that they claim that is based on the court's jurisdictional ruling, that only flows from the legal reasoning here and not the judgment. They're only interveners. They're not in the case. The only issue they can bring up
we
to this case.
We have held repeatedly that there has to be standing on interveners. That's not the problem.
Right. You said that repeatedly, and they have to show that standing, and unless they can show an injury from the actual relief here, which is the consent decree, and that's what Fund for Animals and other cases in this court say we should look at is the relief, they're not injured for standing purposes. And the consent decree here only is simple, only includes those two dates, and there's no way that causes the injury sufficient for them to have standing. Unless the court has any additional questions, I will.
Thank you, counsel.
My time,
we'll hear from the other appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Peterson, and I represent Plaintiff Appellees, Defenders of Wildlife, and the Sierra Club. I think it might be helpful if I begin with clarifying our theory of standing in this case.
That would be real helpful, yeah.
My client's interest is in compliance with the Clean Water Act and clean water. The Clean Water Act citizen suit provision gives my clients a right to compel EPA to comply with the statute. Our standing is dependent upon.
So it's more particular than that, to non-discretionary duties.
That's correct.
Right.
Our standing is dependent upon EPA taking final action to complete the long overdue review. And that's the consent decree, that's certain to occur with the consent decree. The consent decree requires EPA to take that final action. In contrast, UAG's interest is in delaying a rulemaking that's authorized, if not required, by the Clean Water Act.
But their interest is in the content of regulations that govern them as regulated industries. We get that all the time. That's not even unusual. That's what we live on is regulated entities petitioning for review of the regulations.
But possible future revisions of the steam electric ELGs are not the subject of this action. And their standing argument here is dependent upon EPA issuing more stringent rules than the regulations justify.
Isn't yours dependent upon EPA issuing more stringent rules? If they don't issue more stringent rules, what have you gotten out of your lawsuit?
Your Honor, it's not dependent upon EPA issuing more stringent rules because even
what is the relief that you could get in this lawsuit that remedies your harm unless it's more stringent rules?
Because after 25 years, my clients will finally have the ability to seek judicial review of EPA's failure to control and limit discharges of arsenic, mercury, selenium, toxics from power plants.
So in the end, it comes down to the content of the final rule. Either your standing or that of the putative intervener both come down to the content of a final rule.
No, Your Honor.
Yes, counsel.
It comes down to either EPA makes a formal determination not to revise, in which my clients can seek judicial review of that decision.
Yeah. Or it makes a more stringent rule, and then UAG can seek judicial review. Either way, it makes a final decision. Either way, the offended party can then go to court, right?
But what's the consent decree, the procedural breach here is that EPA's failed to complete the required review. And the consent decree gives.
Could you have petitioned for a rulemaking? Could you have petitioned EPA for a rulemaking?
Your Honor, we have filed comments on plans that asking EPA to do this. But we also have the right to file a citizen suit.
We understand that if you have standing, you have a right to bring a citizen suit. But if you had filed a petition for a rulemaking, would that not have put it in the administrative process, which would have presumably gotten you to the point where you could come to this court on a denial?
But Your Honor, we have the, you know, the Clean Water Act citizen suit gives us the ability to file a suit to compel.
If you have standing.
Right. And we do
statutes
have.
Statutes can't create Article III standing. I mean, they can create a right, the breach of which gives you Article III standing, but as counsel for the government pointed out, that's not where we look at standing from, not from where the court's decree comes in, but from what the relief is sought in the lawsuit.
Your Honor, in this case, my clients do have standing. Their members have suffered an injury, in fact, caused by EPA's failure to complete this long overdue rulemaking, where EPA itself concedes that the current standards don't adequately control toxic discharges, and they don't reflect current wastewater treatment technologies. And the consent decree here remedies those injuries because it requires EPA to finally.
The consent decree, as I understand, all the consent decree gives you is the review, right? At the end of the review, they may not change it. It's likely to, but they may not, right? So
what will have changed at the end of this consent decree is that my clients will finally have the ability to seek judicial review of EPA's failure to regulate toxics, which they don't have now.
There would be final action, right?
There would be final action. And that's the allegation, is that EPA has failed to take this final action. The UAG's standing argument is dependent upon more stringent regulation than the Clean Water Act justifies. They're essentially asking the court to find an injury in fact caused by rules that don't yet exist and they may never exist. And the district court...
You know, that's the disturbing thing about this whole case for us, is that the whole case concerns regulations that don't exist and may never exist. And that's not the norm when parties have standing.
Your Honor, but this action, the action here that we're talking about today is EPA's failure to complete this required review. And we do have standing for that action. UAG also suggests that they have standing based on impacts from the rulemaking process itself or the schedule here. And with respect to impacts that flow from the rulemaking process, they concede they have no legally protectable interest in delaying or authorizing a rulemaking that's authorized by the Clean Water Act. And for purposes of Article III standing, there's no causation here because EPA voluntarily initiated this rulemaking.
But the EPA, there's a change that's taking place right here. EPA has approached the issue of effluent limitations in a certain fashion for a number of years, right? And now they've changed. They're doing something different. It changes the legal terrain on which UAG walks. Don't they have standing to challenge that change? Because what it's going to require now, as counsel pointed out, is reviews that occur on a periodic basis that they're far more often than EPA's prior position. Prior policy. Why isn't that a significant change that they get to come to court and say it's unlawful? That's an unlawful change.
Your Honor, nothing about this lawsuit changes the obligations that the statute imposes upon EPA. EPA has...
There's a very lively dispute about what the statute imposes upon EPA. It's not clear, is it?
I think what's important to remember is that EPA has discretion in terms of how it conducts these reviews that are required by the statute, mm-hmm. and they have discretion as to whether or not they revise the effluent limitation
the fact
guidelines.
The review is not discretionary.
That's correct. So it's not an impossible task because EPA is able to, has discretion in terms of how it chooses to review it and whether or not it will revise the ELGs. EPA is not required to conduct a rulemaking process every year. They've chosen to conduct a rulemaking process for this particular source category, but that doesn't mean that they're required to do a rulemaking every year for each of the source categories. The other point I'd like to make is that the schedule here goes well beyond what the law requires for participation in a rulemaking process. The schedule doesn't harm UAG. They have plenty of protection, as this court has recognized. They can participate in the rulemaking process, and they've done that since at least 2010. They can.
But the consent decree, so the consent decree is different than had EPA announced on its own that it was going to conduct the review, right? Because if the EPA had announced on its own it's going to conduct the review, it has discretion to stop conducting that review, right? Whereas under the consent decree, that discretion is gone.
Under the consent decree, they retain discretion to determine whether or not revisions are appropriate. So they're not required
to. But they don't contain. They don't have discretion whether to conduct the review, right?
No, because the statute.
In the case of the review.
No, the statute requires EPA to conduct these reviews. To accept UAG's argument based on the schedule, the court has to assume that EPA is going to revise the rules, that EPA is not going to get the additional time if it genuinely needs it, and that the schedule itself will cause procedural flaws that will cause the rule to be more stringent than the rules justify, and that these rules will cause UAG to suffer an injury in fact. And that's exactly the type of layered speculation that can't provide the basis for standing. Unless the court has further questions.
Seeing none, thank you, counsel.
Okay. In conclusion, the district court had subject matter jurisdiction, and this court should affirm the district court's denial of UAG's motion to intervene as of right.
Thank you, counsel. How much time did appellant have left? Okay. You got 3 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. That's discretionary.
I understand it. I'll be brief. Very brief. I'll make three quick points. First, the plaintiffs themselves appear to concede that the only non-discretionary duty imposed by the statute is the duty of review. And the Clean Water Act does not require the agency to complete a review, to announce a formal determination, or to take any other action.
Don't they get to determine what review means?
That agency gets to determine
what the
review
means. Isn't that what they've done? They've decided that? And
they have. That's right. But the theory of the plaintiff's case is that they don't get to decide. That they must complete a review.
Well, that's only because the agency has made the decision that review means complete the review, and now they've entered into an agreement with parties that they'll do that.
The agency has never made the decision that review means complete the review. The agency did, in fact, complete the review in this case, and so they're willing to move on with the rulemaking. But the agency has never said that in order to satisfy our obligation to review in the effluent limitations and guidelines collectively.
So would you have authority, if forget the consent decree, it's a hypothetical situation, EPA announces after 28 years we're finally going to conduct the review of effluent limitations. Would you have any authority to seek to enjoin that review?
No, because the agency is free to conduct the review, and it has the discretion to decide, now we're done. Let's move on with the rulemaking.
What they've done here?
That is what they've done here. Plaintiffs argue that they had a duty to do that at some time in the past that they haven't identified. That's the non-discretionary duty that they allege.
And that's the source of your harm?
No, that's the source of their alleged harm. Mm-hmm. So our harm is
the fact that it's going to be done.
From the theory that now they must do this. If that's what the statute requires, well, that's what it's going to require every year and every 5 years. Number one. Number two, the government appears to believe that the only thing that the plaintiffs have to do is allege a duty that the court can imply. If you accept that, you will be overturning 20 years of this circuit's precedent. This is not the way that this court has applied the non-discretionary duty provisions of either the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act or other clearly jurisdiction-conferring provisions. And with that, I will close. Thank you so much.
Seeing no questions, thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.